From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Robert Fisk's reports from the Gulf carry no disclaimers about military censorship. He isn't playing by the rules. He won't join a pool and won't submit his writing to military censors. Fisk is the Middle East correspondent for the London newspaper The Independent. On today's Fresh Air, we speak to him from Saudi Arabia and find out why and how he's getting around the censors. Also today, we talk about politics and poetry with Lithuanian poet Tomas Venclova. The Soviets expelled him from his country 14 years ago. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording by Arthur Schnabel in which we hear the pianist blank out and lose his place. And David Bianculli reviews a new TV movie about Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Baghdad Radio announced today that Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz will soon return to Moscow with Saddam Hussein's answer to the Soviet peace proposal. Details of the Soviet plan haven't been made public, but sources have said it calls for an unconditional Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait and offers guarantees for the protection of Iraq's governmental structure and its borders. UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar said the Soviet initiative was a historic opportunity. The plan has also been endorsed by Italy. House Speaker Thomas Foley said that if the Iraqi withdrawal is unconditional, he didn't see how President Bush could fail to accept it. The head of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the French Senate says the leaders of the Allied coalition have granted Iraq until Thursday night to respond to the Soviet peace plan. Lynn Terry has more from Paris.
French Senate leader Jean-Luc Canouet said the Allies had decided to give Iraq until tomorrow night to announce it would withdraw from Kuwait without conditions. He said if that were done, the road would be open for a ceasefire. McKenaway made this statement following a closed meeting this afternoon in which French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas briefed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the Gulf War. Foreign Ministry officials later tried to downplay his remarks. They said Dumas had only insisted that France and its allies wanted Iraq to respond immediately in the hours to come, meeting tonight and tomorrow. Officials said Lucanaway's comments went beyond what Dumas had actually said. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
U.S. forces today had at least four encounters with Iraqi troops. According to U.S. officials, the Iraqis suffered heavy damage. One American soldier was killed and seven injured. NPR's Richard Harris reports from the Pentagon that officials say this activity should not be considered the first phase in a ground war.
General Thomas Kelly said American troops are being more aggressive in patrolling the Iraqi border, and that's why there are more skirmishes with Iraqi troops. The most dramatic incident reported today by the Americans was when four U.S. helicopters attacked a series of bunkers. Between 450 and 500 Iraqi soldiers surrendered to those helicopters, and they were carried back to POW camps in Saudi Arabia. General Kelly cautioned that this easy surrender was an isolated incident and does not reveal the resolve of the whole Iraqi army. Indeed, elsewhere along the border, Iraqi forces fought hard against a U.S. patrol. General Kelly said artillery fire killed one soldier and wounded seven others before U.S. forces destroyed the artillery position. This is Richard Harris at the Pentagon.
Stock prices closed broadly lower today on the news of rising inflation in January. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 33 points to close at 2,899. Declines led advances by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 186 million shares. This is NPR News. Faced with growing pro-democracy protests, Albania's president has promised to form a new government. President Ramiz Aliyev appeared on national television to announce the new government, but he didn't say whether he'd form a coalition that would include opposition parties. The announcement came after about 5,000 protesters in Tirana overturned a giant bronze statue of Enver Hoxha, the father of communist Albania. More than 700 university students and professors ended a hunger strike today after Albania's premier said he'd yield to their demand that Hoxha's name be removed from the university. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling has cleared the way for immigrant farm workers to challenge immigration policies that make it difficult for them to obtain legal residency. Shoshana Edelberg of member station WUSF in Tampa reports.
The ruling stems from a 1988 lawsuit brought by two refugee advocacy groups in Florida. Haitian and Mexican farm workers complained that U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service policy made it essentially impossible for them to win residency permits. Folly Gaspower of Migration and Refugee Services in Palm Beach, Florida, says today's ruling will allow the farm workers to challenge the INS in federal court.
It will make a lot of difference on those people's lives. Now, they can go to immigration and file claim for the due process.
The ruling could affect 100,000 cases across the country. For National Public Radio, this is Shoshana Edelberg in Tampa.
Bank of America said today that it's cutting its prime rate by 0.25%. Effective tomorrow, the bank's rate to its best customers will drop from 9% to 8.75%. The prime rate is important because it sets a standard for many types of consumer loans. Bank of America is the nation's second largest bank after Citibank. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Reporters covering the war in the Gulf are operating under military restrictions. Their contact with coalition forces in the field is limited to supervised pools, and pool reporters must submit their work to military censors. These controversial Pentagon rules are the subject of a Senate committee hearing today. Some reporters in the Gulf are choosing to violate the rules, go off on their own, and bypass the censors. One of those reporters is Robert Fisk. Fisk is the Middle East correspondent for the London newspaper The Independent, and formerly wrote for The Times. He's covered wars in Lebanon, Iran, and Ireland. For the past 14 years, he's been based in Beirut. He joined us a few months ago to discuss his book, Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon. We wanted to find out why Fisk won't join a pool and play by the military's rules, so we called him in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Way back in August, when President Bush took the decision to send troops to Saudi Arabia, I suspected that there would be considerable restrictions placed on the press if, in fact, this turned into a war. And at the time, in fact, I spoke to my editors in London and told them that there probably would be some kind of pool system set up, as the Americans have done before and as, of course, the British did in the Falklands, but that I didn't want to be part of it because I felt that it would inhibit reporting, that my job as a Middle East correspondent would be made much more difficult because, of course, I have to analyze events as well as report them, and also because I felt that the old-fashioned method of reporting wars, of going out on your own and being an eyewitness, was in the end the most truthful way of doing the job.
Are the rules for British reporters the same as the rules for American reporters?
They're very similar. As with the Americans, the British who came here, not on the pools, but all reporters who come here, were asked at the beginning of this crisis to sign a security agreement that we would not give away the locations of military units or future operational plans of military units. I indeed signed this along with all my colleagues. It was an agreement virtually identical to that which reporters accepted in Vietnam. And indeed, it's a set of rules which I have always imposed on myself in the Middle East, whichever country I'm reporting from. I think it would be quite wrong if we endangered the lives of those to whom we spoke on any side in the Middle East. So, like my colleagues, I signed this. It was my suspicion, hitherto and afterwards borne out, that the pools would not only be kept a long way from particular events, but could be organized and would find themselves, by a process of constant presence with the military, that the journalists who would be with the military would find that they became almost, if you like, part of the Army, part of the Air Force, part of the Navy. It's natural, I think, that if a person is pushed into a situation of danger, one comes to seek comfort from those around oneself. One comes to seek safety, of course, advice from them. And you become, you feel yourself part of the group you're with. And it seemed to me that while there may well be a case for reporters doing this, it would be quite wrong to allow a pool system to be the exclusive way of reporting a war.
As a British reporter, are you expected to submit your reports to the military before publishing it?
No. The only submission of reports is done by those on pools. When I go out in the desert on my own, or when, for example, I went to the Battle of Hafshi, I wrote my report and I sent it to London as I would in any other Middle East war, and it was not censored or scrutinized before being published.
How do you get around the military censors? And, well, how are you operating on your own? I mean, I thought that the military would try to prevent any independent reporter from operating outside of the pools.
Well, I think you have to understand that Saudi Arabia is a very big place and that deserts are huge. You have to understand there's not a big room full of sensors here. What happens is that there are a large number of journalists scattered around Saudi Arabia, some in the desert areas, in towns, some in Dhahran, which is where the major U.S. air base is, some in Riyadh, and one or two down in Jeddah. It's impossible to expect all these people, or rather to keep an eye on all these different people. Now, it was always understood, you see, that the military would impose a form of censorship on reporters in pools. The military had decided to use the pool system to throttle information by telling other journalists who were not on the pools that they would basically have to stay in their hotels or in the towns in which they'd found their hotels, and their job would be expected to be to recycle the pool material over to their newspapers. They never expected that reporters who were not in the pools would try to do their own job correctly, as reporters always have. So no system of censors was ever set up for the reporters operating on their own.
Has the British military complained to your paper, The Independent?
Not to my knowledge, no.
What kind of stories have you been getting that you don't think you'd be able to get if you were part of a pool?
Well, for example, about 6 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, I was out in the desert and found a number of very serious problems afflicting the Allied armies. One was that many convoys were getting lost. In one occasion, I discovered that an Allied convoy had traveled 220 miles in the wrong direction and had actually got within 200 yards of an Iraqi artillery battery right on the Kuwaiti border before it discovered its mistake. And the reason these mistakes were being made is that hardly any of the convoy commanders had been issued with maps. On another occasion, I found the medical authorities fearing that the commanders did not realize the scale of bloodshed that might occur in a land offensive. I discovered that they were actually building temporary mass graves beside their hospital, field hospitals, to accommodate those patients who died in their care, because they feared that the administrative arrangements for taking the remains of dead soldiers to the rear were not sufficient to cope with the number of casualties in the war. This is a typical example of a story which I obtained by not being on a pool, and which no pool reporter, in fact, would be given access to.
When you were exploring the town of Kafji after the coalition forces had reported victory, a network television reporter from a pool shouted obscenities at you and basically told on you, tried to turn you in to the military running the pool reports. Can you describe what happened?
Yes, I was out just outside the town of Hafshi at this point, and I was in fact in the company of U.S. troops to whom I was talking and to whom I'd identified myself as a journalist, when a pool television reporter, as you accurately say, came up to me and began to curse me and immediately brought up a public affairs officer from the American Marines who told me I wasn't supposed to be there. The American television pool reporter then told me I should go back to Dhahran, that I was ruining it for him and his colleagues, even though he and his colleagues, in fact, had been kept out of the battle 20 miles away and had reported originally that the battle was over when I'd already discovered it was not. I thought it was a sad and, I think, for the pool concerned, a humiliating episode, because it suggested that the reporter concerned felt his priorities were such that he had placed a greater, for him, the privilege of being in the pool was more important than the ability of another journalist, in this case myself, to do my job. I thought that was a very sad reflection on the reporter and on the pool system. Although, as I say, I think that becoming a member of the pool, living with a military unit, does alter and fragment a journalist's sense of perspective, and I think it does so for the worse.
Has anything else like that happened to you?
Not so far, although some of my colleagues have run into faintly similar circumstances and found themselves told and ordered to go away by military officers in charge of pools. I think the real problem is that, you see, originally the system of the pool was quite a sensible one. the military decided that it was impossible to take, for example, 800 journalists onto a warship. You would obviously have to take a few and allow the other journalists to use the material which those reporters on the ship sent them. And the same would apply to a missile battery or a tank unit. But what the military have done in Saudi Arabia is they've manipulated this system, and instead of saying, okay, we'll take a few journalists with military units, the rest of you can do their job, they've said, we'll take a few journalists to military units, and the rest of you are not allowed to go anywhere, thus, in fact, trying, and at the moment, hopefully, still failing, to control all information which the press can gather.
My guest is Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for the London newspaper The Independent. He's speaking to us from Saudi Arabia. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Fisk is my guest, a journalist who is not cooperating with the military press restrictions in the Gulf. Have you been reading the pool reports in American and British newspapers?
I've been reading the actual original pool reports until I found that they, frankly, reflected the reality so little of what I see in the desert that I really stopped reading them. Some of them were couched in cliches and had so obviously... We're so obviously reading like military handouts that they seem to me to be virtually useless, although I should add that that does not apply in all cases. Some reporters have kept their distance from the military by being within the pools and have managed to get over the fact that war is not about soldiers claiming that they're itching for action, but that it's about fear and boredom and homesickness as well. And to this degree, I think some of the reporters in the pools have done their job, but that unfortunately does not apply to all of them.
There's, I think, around 1,000 reporters in Saudi Arabia now, is that right?
I think it's about 1,300, although the figure varies between that and 800. In fact, the numbers of reporters here, this is a statistic that varies almost as much as the number of Iraqi tanks each day that we are told have been destroyed.
Do you think the presence of so many reporters could be very disruptive to the coalition forces if each of those 1,300-some-odd reporters were off roaming on their own?
No, because most of them are not. Many of the people you're calling reporters are, in fact, engineering staffs for American television networks, field producers who would never have any business leaving the area of the cities in which they're based. You're only talking, in fact, of a few hundred reporters, and many of them don't wish to go into the desert or into the front lines. Given the few who are, in fact, doing so, I shouldn't think they number more than about 80 to 100, and there's certainly no danger to the coalition forces in an area of so many tens of thousands of square miles, having 100 or so reporters around.
Can you give us a sense of how you spend the typical day and how you decide where to go, what story to cover?
Well, sometimes, of course, I'm not out in the desert, but I normally try to travel with one or two colleagues who share my views on the way the war should be covered, and we normally take particular routes, which usually include Allied supply routes, where we know we can talk to soldiers and where we know where units are, and we can go to desert villages where we know some of the soldiers now and can talk to them, and in some cases can approach very close to the Kuwaiti border, so close that we can see the fires of the B-52 bombings on the Iraqis and can actually pick up it, for example, so close we can pick up the leaflets which the Allied aircraft drop, ordering or suggesting or trying to persuade the Iraqi soldiers to surrender.
Do you feel safe when you're off on your own? And you know, I should mention here that one of your best friends, Terry Anderson, who was Middle East correspondent for the Associated Press, has been held hostage for 6 years. Bob Simon and his crew from CBS TV are in captivity somewhere. How safe do you feel on your own?
The case of Terry Anderson does not apply here. Terry is a victim of a quite different tragedy in Lebanon. Bob Simon, in fact, as far as I understand, was actually inside Saudi Arabia when he and three of his colleagues were captured by the Iraqis. Certainly, I've been to the place where he was captured, but when I went there, there were Egyptian troops there. I understand that when he was captured, those troops were not there, so the area was more dangerous, and forward Iraqi patrols were there. I don't think there's any doubt that being a journalist in a war zone is dangerous. You only have to ask those correspondents who covered Vietnam. And certainly journalists have been killed in Lebanon as well as kidnapped in that particular war. I think, on the other hand, if you're going to report a war, you have to start on the basis that it will be dangerous, that you have a duty to yourself and to your relatives as well as to your newspaper not to get into trouble if it's possible. But, of course, it is a dangerous place. There's no point in denying it, and if one tried to persuade oneself it was not dangerous, one would end up in trouble.
What do you plan on doing if and when a ground war starts? Where do you...
I'm not going to answer that question because I don't want to give away what my plans are at the time.
Oh, okay. Because, is that because...
let me put it this way. If the authorities want to stop journalists who are not on the pools covering the war, I don't particularly want to talk about my own plans for covering the war. It's as simple as that.
Do you think that you would be stopped if they knew where you were?
I don't know.
There haven't been any attempts to stop you yet, though, right?
On two occasions, I've been stopped at checkpoints and told I can't continue, but I have spoken to the soldiers and persuaded them that it's a good idea that I should continue, and they've permitted me to do so.
These were Saudi or American soldiers?
In one occasion, they were Saudi, and in one occasion, they were Western soldiers.
When you're trying to speak with the military, with troops or with officers, are you ever afraid that they'll turn on you and, you know, report you to the censors or something?
Put. No, if they don't want to talk to journalists, they say so. But normally, you know, you have to understand that soldiers are in the desert, they're lonely, they're frightened, they like to see a friendly face. If a Briton or an American sees a British journalist, he's much more likely, as most soldiers do, to ask me what I know is going on. Is it true there's been a peace offer from Iraq? Is it true that the Americans are still bombing Iraq? Than he is to want not to talk. Soldiers need news. Very often we take with us newspapers, which we buy in Tehran or in Riyadh, so that they can see them. They want to read them. And we often exchange our thoughts on the war. In this way, it's very interesting. They have a lot of thoughts which they've worked out on their own out in the desert. And, of course, we have a lot of political views, too. So, in a way, we have very interesting conversations, and they're very keen to hear what news we have and what we've heard on the radio or seen on television. They can't watch television, of course, out there. And, as I say, we take along newspapers, both American and British, for them to read.
Well, Robert Fisk, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Fisk is Middle East correspondent for the London newspaper The Independent. He spoke to us from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. A while back, Fresh Air's classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviewed a recording of a live 1946 performance of Arthur Schnabel playing a Mozart piano concerto. In the last movement, the legendary pianist had a lapse of memory, but this passage was edited out of the recording. Lloyd said that someday he'd like to hear what the actual event sounded like, and he got his wish.
When I reviewed the new recording of the marvelous but troubled live performance by Arthur Schnabel of Mozart's 23rd Piano Concerto, I had mixed feelings about the decision of the Music and Arts Record Company to release a disc in which the notorious passage in the last movement where Schnabel lost his place was edited out. He apparently had to stop, get up, and look at the conductor's score before he could complete the concerto. The recording is of particular historic importance because Schnabel never made a studio recording of this glorious work. It's a great performance, especially of the first two movements, but Schnabel was experiencing some technical difficulties in the high-speed finale and evidently got distracted. Surely it would have been painful to hear this failure every time you play the new disc, but I was certainly curious about what really happened at this famous concert with the New York Philharmonic in 1946. A couple of weeks ago, a thoughtful listener sent me a tape of the actual radio broadcast. I thought you'd be interested in sharing my discovery. First, here's what the passage sounds like on the Schnabel CD.
Thank you.
Now here's what really happened. It's funny, but I really think the unedited version is better. Something about the pace of the real event makes more sense, is actually more satisfying than the cleaned-up version. There's a human drama. Schnabel's technical mishaps throughout the last movement reach an ultimate point of impasse. He hits bottom. Everything stops. Then he recovers. He plays the brilliant coda triumphantly with renewed vigor and vitality. Of course, neither version of this movement can be a completely satisfying rendition of what Mozart wrote. But as Robert Lowell wrote in Epilogue, the last poem of his last book, why not say what happened? The new CD, however, is still indispensable, and in the slow movement, Schnabel once again demonstrates through his profound shaping of Mozart's phrases that music can be very slow, yet have inexorable forward momentum at the same time. There's actually another notorious Schnabel passage on this new disc that I didn't get to mention in my last review. Schnabel composed his own cadenzas for Mozart's tragic 24th piano concerto in C minor, and they sound more like Schoenberg than Mozart. It's been a source of great controversy. I think it's fascinating, but it's also important to keep in mind that in none of Schnabel's magnificent interpretations is controversy the most important element.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. 14 years ago, when Lithuanian poet and dissident Tomas Venclova came to America to lecture, he discovered the Soviet Union had closed the door behind him by revoking his Soviet citizenship and forbidding his return. Coming up, the politics and poetry of Tomas Venclova. And there's a new made-for-TV movie about one of the most famous acting couples in history, Sir Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. TV critic David Bianculli tells us if it does the couple justice. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to Baghdad Radio, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein will send his foreign minister back to Moscow soon with an answer to a Soviet peace plan. There has been no indication as to whether the Iraqi leader has agreed to the plan for averting a ground war in the Persian Gulf. While the Soviet Union waits for Iraq to reply to its proposal, Secretary of State James Baker demanded that Iraq leave Kuwait immediately, totally and unconditionally. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
These remarks, delivered during a toast for Denmark's Queen Margrethe, sounded like an ultimatum. Amid rumors of an impending ground war, Baker said one way or another the Iraqi army of occupation will leave Kuwait soon. His comments followed a telephone call with Soviet Foreign Minister Alexander Besmertnik about the Soviet proposal that President Bush said yesterday falls well short of what would be required. A U.S. official said the Soviets can promise what they want, a reference to reports Gorbachev has reassured Saddam Hussein he will not be punished. But according to this official, the Soviets aren't in a position to deliver. By taking the diplomatic initiative, the Soviets have put the administration in a difficult position. But according to one U.S. official, Baker's statement today is the administration's last best offer to Iraq. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Meanwhile, in New York City, the U.N. Secretary General and other diplomats have expressed mixed feelings about whether the Soviet proposal will provide a solution to the crisis in the Persian Gulf. Linda Vasulo reports from the U.N.
Javier Perez de Cuellar says the Soviet plan is a unique opportunity to solve the Gulf crisis. However, Washington has given no sign that it will hold off its ground war until Iraq has delivered its reply to Moscow. The UN chief speculated logistical problems may be causing the delay in responding, and his suggestion that the coalition give the Soviet offer a chance was echoed by some diplomats here. But Saudi Ambassador Samir Shihabi said there's only one way out of the war, and that's for Saddam Hussein to leave Kuwait. Although Shihabi did not directly support a move to depose Saddam, he said the Iraqi dictator's policy has threatened the Mideast and pointed out we would like to eliminate threats to the region. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
According to official news reports from Iran, grenades were thrown today at three Western embassies in Tehran, but no one was injured. The attacks on the British, Italian, and Turkish embassies apparently caused some damage. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 33 points to close at 2,899.01 on volume of 186 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 2 to 1. This is NPR News. Officials in Germany say the first budget since unification will call for more than $265 billion in expenses. More than $7 billion of this amount is for the Persian Gulf War. The German finance minister presented the 1991 budget proposal to the cabinet, but did not include estimates on how much would be raised in planned tax increases. German Chancellor Kohl, who had pledged in last year's election campaign not to increase taxes for German unification, has said since then that a tax increase might be necessary to pay for military operations in the Persian Gulf War. In Washington state today, trial began for a Lutheran minister on a hunger strike, who is charged with trespassing during an anti-war demonstration. Carol Levinson reports.
Carl Floria of Wenatchee, Washington, has not had solid foods in more than a month. He says he's fasting until the Persian Gulf War ends. Until recently, Floria was in jail for participating in an anti-war protest outside the federal courthouse in Wenatchee. Floria reportedly argued in court today that his trespassing was justified in light of what he called the greater crimes committed in the Persian Gulf. The judge rejected that argument, however. A jury was chosen and testimony is underway. Floria says he's lost 26 pounds since he started the hunger strike in mid-January. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson reporting.
Officials of the European Community have approved measures to help their airlines deal with the impact of the Persian Gulf War. The Executive Commission says that it will look with favor at agreements between airlines on prices and capacity and an aid from member states to help airlines compensate for increased security and insurance expenses related to the Persian Gulf War. The Commission also encouraged member states to speed up action on fare change applications and to relax rules on airlines offering non-regular services such as charters. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Since January, the Soviet government has tightened its grip on the Baltic republics, trying to suppress the independence movements. My guest is the Lithuanian poet Tomas Venclova. He was stripped of his Soviet citizenship in 1977. The letter he received from Soviet authorities charged he'd exhibited behavior unbecoming a Soviet citizen. Venclova was a political dissident and human rights activist. He also translated the works of such Western writers as T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas, and James Joyce. Venclova has lived in this country for the last 14 years and now teaches at Yale. He visited his mother and friends in Vilnius back in October. Venclova told me despite the setbacks, he remains hopeful about Lithuania achieving its independence.
I am a sort of a historical optimist, which means that I am optimistic as concerning the final result, but I don't feel that I will live long ago to see that final result. But recently I become simply optimistic, not just historically optimistic, and believed that I will live long enough to see this final result myself, that is Lithuanian independence. And I would add that even now, I am still optimistic. I think that Lithuania can achieve her independence, not only formal independence, but also factual independence, in the worst case, probably 2 or 3 years from now.
What does independence for Lithuania mean to you personally?
Well, that simply means normal life. That simply means absence of fear. That means absence of censorship. That means open borders with the West. That simply means market and heightening of standards of life. All those things are important for any nation, and including Lithuania.
You were stripped of your citizenship in Lithuania. What reasons were you given for that?
I took part in Lithuanian and also in the General Soviet dissident movement. I was a member, to be precise, I still am a member of the Lithuanian Helsinki Group, a group of dissidents who tried to monitor the Soviet performance according to the Helsinki agreements. That means the situation of the human rights in Lithuania. And some of members of the Lithuanian Helsinki group were arrested. One of them spent 9 to 10 years in prison. And I belonged to the small group of those Helsinki monitors who were thrown out of the Soviet Union and of Lithuania. I was given a Soviet passport and allowed to go to the United States because the university in Berkeley, California, was inviting me to give a course of lectures. And during my stay at Berkeley, I got a letter from the Soviet authorities that my Soviet citizenship has been revoked.
Now, why do you think that they wanted you out of the country as opposed to in prison?
Well, it's difficult to tell. I am wondering myself because both results were quite possible. Probably because my case was better known in the West and my name was mentioned on the Western radio. In such situations, the Soviets sometimes take care of the world opinion.
Do you think that the Soviet government was disturbed by your poems? You mentioned your work in the Helsinki group and the human rights group, but what about your poetry itself? Was that considered a threat?
Maybe, because my poetry was, at least in part, it is metaphysical and private and so on and so on. I write love poems and experimental poems, which are not always too intelligible and so on. But I also wrote some civic poetry, some political poetry, and it was never published, but it was known in the so-called samizdat. That means that people put it on the typewriter and distributed it among themselves. And this kind of poetry, of course, was far from being welcome from the point of view of the Soviet government. Some of it has been published in the West before I left Lithuania, in Russian and Polish emigre newspapers. That was also, of course, less than welcome from the point of view of the Soviet government.
My guest is Lithuanian poet Tomas Venclova. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Lithuanian poet Tomas Venclova is my guest.
I'd love it if you read a poem for us. There's a poem I'd particularly like to have you read, and you'll be reading the English translation of it. And this is a poem in the memory of a friend of yours who was killed in the Soviet Union by the KGB. Maybe you could explain to us the background of the poem.
Yes, it is a poem about a Russian dissident, Konstantin Bogatyrov, who lived in Moscow, who was my close friend. He was a translator, mainly a translator of poetry into Russian. Konstantin Bogatyrov spent part of his life in prison, and in Stalin times he was even given a death sentence, which was later changed, and he got 25 years of imprisonment. He spent in prison only 8 years. He was let out after Stalin's death, but because of his involvement in the dissident movement, he was attacked close to his apartment, hit on the head, and he died after 2 months of suffering in a hospital. And before his death, he told his wife that they finally managed to execute me. The old sentence went through, so to speak. And in that poem, I also speak about several other deaths of people which occurred at that time. That was late 70s, in Moscow, in Leningrad, in Vilnius. Since I was also quite involved in the movement at that time, I expected a similar fate to myself. And this is a poem about those expectations.
Why don't you read the poem?
Yes, the poem has a title, Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita. This is the first line of the Dante's Divine Comedy. That means in the middle of our life, of our life's path. And it's dedicated to the memory of Konstantin Bogatyrov. Mid-century has overtaken me. I lived but learned to non-exist at that. Death came to be one of the family who claimed the greater portion of my flat. I'd to make her tame little by little. I'd beg her not to touch me with her hand. And in the mornings, I'd observe the city, the loveliest of Eastern Europe's land, as far as I know, where iron awaits its stroke, where rotting rushes rustle in the mist. There is locomotive, knuckle duster, rock, and possibly some gasoline at best. Within this death, I'd sleep, I'd drink, I'd eat. I'd try to give her purposes and sense. I'd even let her slip my mind, but meet her casually. That's almost beyond man's strength. I turned the key in the corridor. The breath would lose its rhythm. The heart would drop its weight onto the chest. To tell the truth, that could even be fortress in this state.
Let me ask you about the last line of that poem. To tell the truth, death could even be fortuitous in this state.
This is an ironic line because so many deaths in the Soviet Union at that time were not fortuitous, were deliberately given by the government, that some percent of fortuitous deaths also happened. This is an ironical line, as you understand, because this percent of fortuitous deaths was really small.
Are you using the word fortuitous to also mean, you know, death could be caused by natural causes?
Yes.
You know, that you're it's so upsetting to know that you might be killed by the Soviet government or by the KGB. It could bring on a heart attack.
Yes, the fortuitous death in my meaning can include the death by natural causes. But the point is that even the natural causes in the Soviet Union are somehow determined by the totalitarian regime, that the government is in full control of life and death of every of its citizens. And this is the most awful, the most terrible thing one can tell about the totalitarian countries, such as Soviet Union, or for that matter China, or for that matter Iraq.
Now, each of your poems are translated into English twice. They have both rhymed and unrhymed versions. Was it your idea to do two different versions of each poem?
Well, that was Diana's idea, but I think it is a right idea because the very tradition of Lithuanian, or for that matter Russian, poetry is different. We tend to use strict metrical schemes and rhyming, sometimes very complex metrical schemes and very complex rhyming. And those poems are generally translated into English just literally, and this does not give the real idea of a poem. A rhymed poem maybe sounds outdated in English because virtually nobody uses strict metrical schemes and rhyming in the United States today. But it gives the idea how the poem sounds in the original.
I don't know how old you are, but I wonder if you have any memories of Lithuania before it was annexed by the Soviet Union.
No, I am already 53. I was born in the independent Lithuania, but I was 3 years old when Lithuania was occupied by the Soviets. So I don't remember the Lithuania before the Soviets. After the Soviets came, in a year, the Germans came, the Nazis came, and I remember the Nazi occupation. During the Nazi occupation, I was already 4 to 6 years old. My first memories concern this second occupation, Nazi occupation, which was also, of course, difficult and awful enough. And after the Germans were expelled by the Soviets came back in 1944, when I was 7 years old, and all my conscious life developed under the Soviet occupation.
Were your parents in the opposition movement?
My father was a leftist, and he joined the Soviets. He even was a minister of education of the Sovietized Lithuania for some time. He was also a writer and a very prolific writer, but he was definitely a Soviet writer and not an anti-Soviet one. So, although my relations with my late father were always very correct, and I would say, even very good, and I loved him, but our political opinions differed very strongly.
You teach Soviet literature now. How did you become a student of Soviet literature?
I teach, to be precise, I don't teach Soviet literature. I teach Russian literature. That is a literature of the opposition to the Soviet regime. I teach such writers as Pasternak, Tsvetaeva, Blok, who were strongly opposed to the Soviet regime and never concealed it. So they lived during the Soviet years, but they cannot be called Soviet writers.
As a Lithuanian poet in exile, what do you feel you can do now for your country?
Well, I am doing at least something, contributing to American press and explaining the situation in Lithuania. I am also talking to various audiences, Lithuanian and not Lithuanian, including English audiences. And I hope that it will reach some American audience. And of course, I continue to write poetry, although I am not a prolific poet, concerning Lithuanian questions. I also visited Lithuania in October and gave lectures and talks and even in a sense was employed unofficially as a sort of consultant to the Lithuanian government.
To do what?
Well, to explain the cultural situation in the West and to prepare some plans for cultural development in Lithuania after it achieves her independence.
Are you in the middle of writing a poem now?
Not today, in any case.
Have you recently finished any poems that relate at all to what's happening in Lithuania now or to your emotions about it?
Well, some of my earlier poems proved to be quite relevant to what is going in Lithuania today. And some of my earlier poems have been published recently in Lithuania and outside Lithuania. But I still don't have any poem about the present developments in Lithuania, partly because I am simply too upset, still too upset because of those tragic events. To write a poem, one has to feel some distance to the events, and it will take probably a month or two when I will be able to feel that distance.
Lithuanian poet Tomas Venclova. He spoke to us from WPKT in New Haven, Connecticut. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, I understand the French are hinting that the ground war could begin at any minute.
Yes, and Robert Siegel has an interview with the French diplomat today, Terry, in which he says that from one evening to the next, Saddam Hussein will have to make a decision about withdrawing from Kuwait. We'll also have stories from Fort Hood, a support group of the wives of some of the men who will be over the line first if there is a ground war. We're going to talk to some Iraqi Americans who are watching with great distress their adopted country destroy the country where they were born. And we'll have a story about Lithuania.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Thursday and Friday night, the Arts and Entertainment Cable Network is presenting a dramatic miniseries about one of the century's most celebrated actor couples. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh starred in two of the greatest romance movies of all time, but not together. He was Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights, and she was Scarlett in Gone with the Wind. Off-screen, shortly before those films were made, they had divorced their respective spouses and married each other, starting a 30-year love story of their own. Their often stormy relationship is the subject of Darlings of the Gods, a 4-hour miniseries on the Arts and Entertainment Network. Now, any time you ask actors to portray other immensely talented actors, you're asking for trouble. Who would you cast, for example, in the Marlon Brando story? But Darlings of the Gods does something to shift the spotlight from Anthony Higgins, who plays Olivier, and Mel Martin, who plays Vivian Leigh. Basically, it presents a story that's so convoluted, with dialogue and structure that's so artificial and awful, that bad acting is the least of its problems. Here's a sample. Vivian is playing Chinese checkers with some handsome young men as her husband sits on the couch and mopes. One guy, Dan, jumps some of Vivian's marbles, and that's when Vivian loses hers. Listen to the dialogue, if you can hear it over the sappy soundtrack music.
Dan is a bloody little sneak. He doesn't play the game.
Larry, do calm her down.
Don't try and come between us. We've been through far too much together. You'd never split us up.
It's late. I think it's time we all turned in.
I could go to hell for all you care.
As annoying as that scene is, other things about Darlings of the Gods are even worse. Like the fact that the story doesn't even begin until 1945, a decade after Olivier and Lee met, and uses only clumsy flashbacks and flash-forwards to show aspects of their careers and private lives that should have been covered more fully. Instead, the drama focuses on the Olivier's arrival in Australia to launch a new play, and on Vivian's extramarital affair with Australian actor Peter Finch. Now why, given the amazing range of everything these actors did, on and off stage and screen, are an Australian setting and an Australian actor given the lion's share of the attention? Could it be that this particular docudrama is an Australian production? Sure enough. But Darlings of the Gods is one import that should have stayed down under.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Our production assistants are Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, The State of the World, Chris Flavin of the World Watch Institute joins us with his organization's annual assessment of the planet's environmental health. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.